I started out like most people, thinking I was going to do something else than what I ended up doing. I thought I was going to become a writer and a poet. That didn't happen, and for a number of reasons, I decided to become an economist. Basically because I ran into a number of very gifted teachers who indicated to me that economics was something more than a subject that you studied in the classroom, but something that you could actually use, and it actually had an impact on things. So I eventually became an economist. I worked first as a academic. I've also worked in the, we'll call it the quasi-private sector. I worked as an advisor for the major industrial group of industrialists in Italy when Guido Carli, who had been the central bank president, became the president of the industrialists. I've also worked as an advisor to financial institutions on Wall Street who are active investors in all sorts of things. And for the last, say, 15, almost 20 years, I guess, I've been working inside the United Nations system, first as an advisor and contributor to the trade and development report of UNCTAD, and then as UNCTAD's representative to the Financing for Development Conference that took place in Monterrey, and after the Monterrey Consensus, with the formation of the Financing for Development Office, I went and worked at the Financing for Development Office in the Secretariat in New York. Eventually, you get old and the UN forces you to retire. So when that happened, I was very fortunate to be able to come back to the Levy Institute, where I had been associated previously when Hyman Minsky first came and worked here and basically set up the program in which we are now working that deals basically with the impact of financial institutions and the financial structure on the operations of the real economy and the ability of the real economy to generate full employment. And that's currently what I'm doing now, aside from teaching in a number of different places, because when you're retired, you can, well, I can't even say you can afford to do this. You have to do this because you can't afford not to. And that's basically the end of the short biographical story. Now, the presentation today will deal basically with four issues. The first issue is to look at the conditions, the current conditions in the U.S. economy, to look at the reasons how we got here and what are the likely future moves of the economy. Within that presentation, there will be a reasonably detailed explanation of the importance of the financial sector, and we will then look in the second section on how the financial sector managed to create as much damage as it in fact did. The third section will then try to move into a more global perspective and to look at the impact of the U.S. crisis on the global economy in general and on developing countries in particular, and to look at the way developing countries are likely to be impacted by not only the crisis but the response to the crisis. In doing this, I'm going to refer a little bit to some of the proposals that were made in the report or the preliminary version of the report of the Stiglitz Commission or the president of the UNGA's Commission on Reform of the International Monetary and Financial System to the recent United Nations conference, and then to try and finish up with some policy proposals that might be useful for both developed and developing countries in trying to meet the difficulties of the crisis. So that's basically the four areas that we're going to try and look at, and hopefully we'll be able to finish all this by 5 o'clock. So if we start very quickly and look at a list of causes of the crisis, now everybody has their own particular idea of what they think caused the crisis. And the list that I put down here is certainly not exhaustive, but it's all the things that I could remember in a reasonably short time. On the top of the list is often the idea of global imbalances or the global savings glut. And what does this mean? Well, basically, the global imbalances refer to the fact that the United States has been running a very large external deficit. That is, it's buying more from the rest of the world than it's selling to the rest of the world. And the rest of the world, as a result, has been accumulating large amounts of U.S. dollars. The savings glut side of the story turns it around a little bit and says that there are a number of rapidly growing Asian economies that have very high savings ratios. Now, why should we emphasize savings ratios? Well, the reason we do this is that if you look in the United States, the savings ratio over the last 15 or 20 years has very rarely been positive at all. If you look at your average Asian economy, you find savings ratios that are in the range of, well, the lower bound of the range is around 20%. And it goes up from there in some countries to as much as 40%. Now, if you look at the difference between your income and your savings, that's your consumption. And if your savings goes up, your consumption goes basically down. So the idea is that since all of these economies were not consuming, it was the American consumer that was left with the role of becoming the consumer. And the idea was that this sort of arrangement is not sustainable. It can't go on forever. And if it can't go on forever, as Herb Stein, a well-known advisor to U.S. presidents, used to say, something that can't go on forever eventually must come to an end. And the argument is that because the global imbalances couldn't continue getting bigger, that is, the U.S. couldn't continue consuming what everybody else in the world would consume, eventually you had to have a crisis, and that's where it came from. Another alternative is that the Federal Reserve left interest rates too low for too long. Well, what does this mean? Well, if you think back to the beginning of the 1990s, the United States had a real estate crisis. Federal Reserve put interest rates down, put them back up again in 1994, caused a small crisis, put them back down again, and the result was a very large expansion in the price of equities. This is what we call the dot-com boom. You remember when the stock market was booming and everybody was creating a new internet technology company. Well, as that boom collapsed in around 2000, the Federal Reserve again put interest rates down and left the interest rates down for a sustained and substantial period. In fact, throughout most of the period of the 2000s until around 2004, 2005, when interest rates started going back up again. And the argument was that since interest rates were so low, it led investors to search for yield, that is, for higher interest rates, and the only way that you can get higher interest rates is taking more risk. And this meant that there were increasingly risky investments that the investors really did not understand. And eventually, it's just like anything that must come to an end comes to an end. Anything that is very risky eventually may, in fact, turn out to be risky. And the crisis was, in fact, an expression of the fact that all of these extremely risky assets eventually did not pay off as expected, and this was one of the causes of the crisis. Another cause was fraudulent lending practices. We've all heard of the subprime mortgage boom and the fact that many people who bought subprime mortgages were not given sufficient information on exactly what they were signing up for. For example, it was very frequent for people to be sold mortgages at what they were told to be a fixed rate, at a fixed rate that was extremely low. Well, the problem was that the rate was fixed, but it was only fixed for a year or 2 years, or at the maximum 3 years. And then at the end of 3 years, what happened? Well, the rate wasn't fixed anymore. It got reset. And not only did it get reset to what was the then prevailing market rate. And not only did it get reset to the prevailing market rate, it got reset with a small premium added on in order to pay the banker for, well, the amount of work that it takes in order to adjust the computer to send you a bill for a higher amount of interest each month. So that people found that they could start borrowing at interest rates that were 2, 3, or 4%, and at the end of a couple of years, they would be paying 8, 9, or 10%. Now, this is a very substantial jump, and if you don't know it's coming, it means that you're probably going to be in difficulty, and this is one of the reasons that people put down for the fact that so many people found it difficult to meet their mortgage payments. Another explanation is financial innovations. That is, banks used to go out and make loans, and they used to hold those loans until people repaid them. This is what we used to call the originate and fund, or the originate and hold method of banking. Well, bankers became very clever, and they said, well, why in the world, if I make you a loan, why should I keep the loan? Because you might not pay it back, and that's a risk, and I don't want to run that risk. Maybe I'll try and lend that loan to somebody else. I'll see if I can get somebody else to buy that loan from me. And this became what we call the originate and distribute model. So a banker would go out and make someone, hopefully not a fraudulent loan, to buy a house, but the banker wouldn't keep the loan until you repaid it. He would take that loan, package it, and then attempt to sell it to somebody else. So the idea was that the banks no longer had the responsibility of the risk that you might not repay. Now, who then did have the risk? Well, the final buyer had the risk. And the difficulty was, in this particular arrangement, is that if I'm the banker and I make you a loan, more or less I know you, okay? I have a pretty good idea of what your credit history is. Maybe you live in the same town that I do. So I've got a reasonably good idea of the likelihood that you're going to repay that loan. On the other hand, if I put 3,000 loans into a big package and sell that package as if it were a single bond, the person who buys it has absolutely no idea what the likely credit risk of those individuals in that loan are going to be. And in general, the people who bought them really didn't pay much attention at all. Now, one of the reasons they did this was because credit rating agencies gave credit ratings on those big pools or those big packages of loans so that all you had to do was to look at the credit rating agency and say, well, if the credit rating agency says that the borrower is good, then I'll buy it. Now, the difficulty with that is that the credit rating agencies didn't look at the individual loans either. That is, they never bothered to ask, is this Ralph or Fred or Fanny or whoever who is actually taking out this loan? They simply looked at the geographical distribution of the loan, and they looked at some basic statistics like income history or repayment history or your credit card file and ran this through a statistical program. And if the statistical program came out right, they said, okay, these people are good borrowers, without having any idea. Now, this is where part of the fraudulent lending practices comes into the story, because part of those fraudulent lending practices was many times people would grant loans without actually verifying if people really had incomes in order to repay those loans. This is what basically we sort of call the no income or statement loans. That is, we take you at your word. If you say that you're earning $10 million a year, that's fine. I'll write you a mortgage for $8 million and you're going to be able to pay it, no problem. So the whole idea was that this change in financial innovations, which allowed banks to remove risk from their own balance sheets, really removed not only the risk from the bank's balance sheets, but it removed the activity of risk assessment from the banking practice. That is, there was nobody who was actually assessing the risk of the kind of lending that was going on. Now, if you think of this feeding back into the idea of the Fed left interest rates too low and people were looking for higher rates of return, it was then quite easy for them to buy these sorts of assets because they did have higher rates of return. But you had no idea that the risks were higher. Now, beyond that faulty risk management practice, well, this is more or less what we've been talking about. That is, the fact that risk was redistributed in the system, but people really didn't know that they were bearing increased risk. Another candidate for a cause of the crisis are hedge funds, private equity funds. Okay, hedge funds operate by borrowing money and investing it and making large amounts of money by doing so. So do private equity firms. Private equity firms make money by buying companies. That is, they don't buy the shares in the company, they buy the companies themselves. And they make money by looking at the company and saying, oh, this company has a lot of cash on its balance sheet. If I buy the company, I get the cash. So I take the money. Now, the cash might have been there for a very good reason. That is, the company may have needed it as working capital. But the private equity fund would simply take the cash away. At the same time, it would look at the operations of the company, saying, my goodness, this company has very low profitability. If I'm going to be able to resell this company, I've got to increase its profits. How can I do that? Well, I can do that by making the company more efficient. Usually making the company more efficient means firing people, reducing employment. And a large proportion of the private equity firms did precisely this. That is, they went in, reorganized, sold off pieces of the firm, and also sold off, well, they didn't sell them off, but fired large proportions of the workforce. So the idea here is that it was these hedge funds and private equity funds that operated with excessive amounts of borrowing, excessive amounts of leverage, which then created the bubble in asset markets, which eventually collapsed. Alternative derivatives, derivative instruments, these are futures, options, and something called a credit default swap. Credit default swap is what? Well, a credit default swap started out as something that was very simple. Okay. If we think of a credit default swap as exchanging the returns on an asset, okay, plus the change in the capital value of that asset, this is basically what a credit default swap is. So if we put it in very simple terms, if I hold a U.S. Treasury bond, and Khurshid, see, I remembered your name because I can see the plaque on the front. If you've got a Mexican bond, okay, my Treasury bond is going to pay relatively low interest, 4 or 5%. Your Mexican bond is going to pay a relatively high rate of interest, 8 or 9%. Now, what we can do is to say, well, why don't we just trade? Okay, you're going to get the return on my bond. I get the return on your bond. But besides that, what we're going to do is to say that if there's a change in the capital value of your bond, okay, that's now going to be my responsibility. So say, for example, your Mexican bond pays 8%. But after we've done the swap, the capital value of that bond goes down by 4%. So then all I get is 8% minus 4. Okay? So what have we done by making that swap? Well, basically what I've done is to take in the risk of the Mexican bond, of the change in the value of the Mexican bond. If the Mexican bond defaults, if Mexico doesn't pay, then what happens? Well, I'm the one that loses, okay? So this is why we call this a credit default swap. What we've done is to trade the risk of default on the bond. You've got the U.S. Treasury bond. We know the U.S. Treasury never defaults. So you have a perfectly risk-free position, and that's what we're talking about in terms of credit default swaps. So as long as we're working on this basis, credit default swaps are something that are reasonably sensible. That is, if I want to, you know, take a gamble on the Mexican government, it allows me to do it. And if you've got a gamble on the Mexican government that you don't want anymore, you can get rid of it, and you can have a perfectly safe treasury bond. Now, the difficulty with the credit default swaps is that people started using them not as a way of trading risk, but basically as insurance policies. That is, insurance policies in the following way. That is, that if I was holding, now let's say, a Mexican bond, and I was worried, What I would do is to go and find a bank, or let's now have Khurshid be the bank, and to say to them, look, I'm holding this Mexican bond and I'm a little nervous about the Mexican government. I think it's going to default. Will you give me insurance that pays me the value of the bond if the Mexican government defaults? And you're going to say, yeah, okay, I'm willing to do that, but this is a risk I'm running. So I'm going to charge you something for it. So I say, okay, I'll pay you a premium, just like I pay a premium on an insurance policy. So I'll give you every month a certain percentage of the value, the face value of the bond. Say it's 1%, 2%. So you're happy. You're getting income every month. I'm happy because if the bond defaults, I don't lose any money. And as long as the bond doesn't default, everybody is very happy. Now, what happens if the bond defaults? I go to Khurshid and say, hey, give me the money. Khurshid said, but I didn't think the bond was going to default. I don't have any money. Okay, now we have a problem. That's the first problem with the credit default swaps. A lot of people who took Khurshid's place, what we call writing a credit default swap, didn't have the money to pay in case the bond defaulted. But what was even worse is that suddenly a whole lot of people who didn't hold Mexican bonds, okay, we started out the example and said, I had a Mexican bond and I wanted to insure it. Suddenly, all of you suddenly decided, gosh, Mexico really looks bad. Maybe I can make a little bit of money by buying a credit default swap on a Mexican bond. So now what we've got is everybody in the world, it's sort of like a lottery. Everybody is sort of betting. And we're running around. Poor Khurshid is here, and he's looking around, and he's saying, gosh, look at all these people who are going to give me money now. I'm going to get very rich because all of you are now going to be paying him every month, 1% or 2% of the bond. But now look what happens if the bond defaults. Okay? Poor Khurshid over here now doesn't have to come up with just the value of one bond, which is the outstanding bond. He's got to come up with, well, the value of the bond for all of you. Okay? So that the risk that he was running by giving that guarantee ballooned when you allow individuals who are not actually holding the bond to create or to hedge that bond. And this is what did happen to a large extent with credit default swaps. So many people say, well, really the crisis was just due to this single fact, a particular kind of derivative, a credit default swap. Keep going. Excessive regulation. Excessive regulation, well, one of the ideas is that the government regulates things too much, and it distorts the way the market works, and if the market works perfectly, then the government gets in the way. And some people have argued that because the government requires credit ratings on, for example, banks and certain types of financial institutions to hold particular types of bonds, that this gave credit rating agencies a very important role to play in the crisis because they could decide whether a bond could be bought by a bank or not bought by a bank. So if I'm now a company or a financial institution trying to wrap up a whole bunch of mortgages into a package and to sell them to a bank, it becomes very important to me to get a good credit rating, what we call a AAA credit rating, on those bonds. Now, where do I get it? Well, I get it from the credit rating agency because the regulation says that I have to get one of these ratings. So I'm so interested in doing this that I say to the credit rating agency, hey, why don't you help me out and tell me how I should put together this package of mortgages in order to get a good rating? And the rating agency will say, yeah, that's fine, but, you know, you have to pay for this. So the individual asking for the rating was, in fact, paying the rating agency in order to give them good ratings. So now we're again back in a case, just like Khurshid was over here. He was very happy when everybody was buying credit default swaps from him, and he was getting all of this income. Suddenly the credit rating agencies became very happy because all financial institutions were coming to them and saying, look, we really need AAA ratings in order to be able to sell these bonds so that we can get them off of our balance sheet so that we don't have the risk. And the credit rating agencies, interestingly enough, became a little bit more compliant in being willing to assign good credit rating good credit ratings to bonds that probably were not all that good credits. And this is one of the reasons, which we said before, that the credit rating agencies, in fact, didn't spend a lot of time actually doing assessment of the credit risk that were involved in the loans. That is, we now know for an absolute fact that no credit rating agency ever opened up one of these packages of loans and actually looked at the loan documents to see even if every mortgage had the required documentation in it. And ex post, when one of the rating agencies went back and checked, they discovered that something like 95% of the loans in many of the packages did not have even the basic required information in order for a loan to have been granted. Okay? So, aside from excessive regulation, we also had the argument of faulty regulation. Faulty regulation is what? Well, faulty regulation says, first of all, that regulators tended to concentrate too much on individual financial institutions. That is, they made sure that a single bank was solvent, that a single bank was safe. But what they failed to recognize is that, say, I was a single bank, and I had a lot of Mexican bonds in my portfolio. And all of those Mexican bonds I had insured by selling Hershid over here. Poor Hershid, you're going to be a millionaire or you're going to be bankrupt, one or the other, by the end of the story today. If I had insured all of those bonds with a credit default swap, the regulator would say, well, look, this bank is perfectly safe. It can't lose because its Mexican bonds can't default. It can't lose any money. But what they forgot to do was to look and see if Hershid could in fact pay me if the bonds defaulted. Okay? They looked at each individual institution, but they forgot to look at the whole system as a whole. And since Hershid was probably either subject to a different regulator or in many cases was not even regulated at all, there was absolutely no way of finding out if what we call the counterparty risk of my portfolio as a bank was safe or not safe. So this is what we call excessive micro-regulation. That is, we regulated the small without looking at the interrelationships between individual financial institutions. And this is what you often hear now when people talk about banks as being not too big to fail, but being too interconnected to fail. That is, there are individual financial institutions that have relationships with so many other financial institutions that if one of them goes down, it brings down the whole system. The other is what we call single variable regulation. Single variable regulation is that increasingly regulators tended to focus on one single indicator of safety and soundness in the system. That is, the ratio of capital, bank capital, to risk-adjusted assets. And this is something that was developed by the Basel Committee in response to a cross-border payments crisis, and in general said that the most important indicator of a bank's soundness or a bank's safety is the amount of capital that it holds. What do we mean by capital? Well, capital is basically what the owners of the bank have put into the bank. Now, since banks are usually held by limited liability companies, it means that the shareholders, how much money have the shareholders put into the bank? Now, traditionally, the way the banks operate, the amount of capital that it has relative to the amount of assets that it can buy, that capital, runs in a ratio of anywhere from 1 to 10 to 1 to 12. So if you get $1 of stockholder money, You can go out and buy $12 worth of, or 12 peso, or 120 pesos worth of Mexican bonds. I should stop with Mexico, because Alicia is going to be disturbed. Is going to be disturbed here. Okay. What the Basel requirement said is said that, well, we really should pay attention to what the bank is buying with its capital. That is, it makes a difference if it's buying Mexican bonds or U.S. government bonds, or if it's lending subprime loans or other things. So it says, let's put a risk weighting on the different kinds of assets that it can buy so that there will be the riskiest kind of asset, which requires what is 100% capital requirement, so it counts as 100%. On the other hand, there are things like U.S. Treasury bonds that are considered virtually riskless. So we don't need to hold capital because we don't think we can lose any money on them. So what you had to do is you went through your entire investments on the bank's asset side of the bank's balance sheet, and you counted. Some counted 100, some counted 50, some counted 25, some counted 12. You added all of this up, and then you said what the bank has to hold is a minimum capital of at least 8% against that entire value. And it became a little complicated because it got split up into different types of capital. But basically, the idea was that this was the basic indicator. Now, if you think about the way this works, it says that you've got something on the liability side of the balance sheet, the bank's capital, that has to have a ratio of the things on the asset side. Now, you remember when we talked about this business of originate and distribute. Originate and distribute was a means of getting those assets off the bank's balance sheet into somebody else. So this type of regulation actually encouraged banks to do a lot of lending, but not to hold those loans, but to sell them. Because if they held them, then they had to keep bank capital in order to do that. The second thing was that, in general, banks tended to find ways of circumventing these rules and regulations. Okay, under Basel I, in general, it was thought that, for example, short-term loans were less risky than long-term loans. So if I had a loan that was less than 1 year, then it had a very low risk weighting. And in particular, the banks found ways of creating what came to be called shadow banks, that is, institutions that were independent from the bank but were created precisely in order to simply buy assets from the bank's balance sheet. And what the banks would then do is to say to the buyers, well, if anything goes wrong, I'll guarantee to you I'll take those loans back again. But the guarantee was how long? Can you guess? 364 days. So it was less than 1 year. So being less than 1 year, instead of having to hold 8% against those loans, the bank had to hold 0.8% against those loans. Okay? So obviously the bank was still responsible for those loans. If they went bad, the bank had to buy them in. But now, instead of holding 8% against 100, they were holding less than 1% against 100. Okay? This is like Harshid again here writing his credit default swaps and not having any money. Basically, the banks could not make good on that commitment to buy back the loans. And when the loans started going bad and they had to buy them back, the bank said, oh, no capital. And the crisis, well, that was one of the reasons the crisis came. But the idea was that this obsession with the single capital variable was one of the major causes of the crisis. Okay, credit rating agencies we've already talked about, off-balance sheet entities, these are the things that we've just been talking about, these shadow banks in which the banks were able to sell these assets fictitiously to something else. Finally, poor people. Obviously, poor people caused the crisis because they've got so much money. Well, that one doesn't sound so good, does it? It sounds a little strange. Well, it is a little strange. But the idea is that many people have argued that because there was a policy that encouraged banks and encouraged government entities to try and provide financing for low-income individuals, that banks made a whole lot of loans for houses to people who were too poor to repay. So, in fact, it was the poor people that caused the crisis, not the bankers, because the bankers were not doing anything bad. They were not making fraudulent loans. They were not telling people that the conditions were not correct. It was simply the fact that people were too poor. If they had been richer, we would never have had a crisis. Well, that's possible, but you know, if they had been richer, they'd probably been a lot better off. Anyway, the bottom is the last, and basically that's why we have such a big list of these things, because it wasn't me. I did not cause the crisis. Whether I'm the banker or the regulator or the credit rating agency or anything else, everybody has an excuse. It was somebody else, and that's why the list is so big. And that's why probably none of these things are really important in having caused the crisis. All of them, yes, they contributed something, but they really didn't have a major or crucial role. Now, we can look at this in a slightly different way, and we can say that were there structural causes in the system that produced the crisis? Okay, if we look at this for on a longer-term level, and we can say, well, yeah, on the international level, we talked about the global imbalances. But there's another way to look at that, those global imbalances, and those global imbalances can also be looked at as a result of what we call the lack of a symmetric policy of adjustment for those imbalances. Okay? We said something can't go on forever, it's going to stop, and the question is, well, why in the world did they go on forever? Why wasn't there something in the system that was going to stop them? One of the ideas is that there was insufficient coordination. Another is that the way the international financial system is set up, there is no means or no mechanism to make sure that imbalances don't go beyond a particular size. Okay? So if you think very simply, if you go back to the old Bretton Woods system in which we had fixed exchange rates, and everybody fixed their currency to the dollar. If you're a country running a deficit, that is, you're importing more goods than you're exporting, you know, you're buying too much from the rest of the world, what happens? Well, you have to pay for those goods, and you have to pay for them at a fixed rate. So how do you pay for them? Well, if you're not a country that produces dollars, then you have to get dollars. You hold dollars as your reserves. But eventually your reserves run out. What happens when your reserves run out? Well, sorry, can't buy anymore. Okay? Nobody's going to sell to you if you don't have dollars. Usually what would happen is long before your reserves ran out, you would go to the IMF, and the IMF would say, oh, well, naughty boy, you spent too much. Now I'm going to have to teach you a lesson. So I'm going to teach you a lesson. Here are some reserves so that you don't starve, so you can continue to buy from the rest of the world. But I'm going to tell you how you run your economy so that you never spend more than you earn. Okay, this is what eventually came to be called IMF conditionality. Okay. Now, the problem with these policies is what? Well, the way to keep countries from spending more than they earn is to reduce their income. Okay? So their income level has to go down. And IMF policy says you have to cut government spending. You have to cut wages and salaries. You have to cut the level of employment. Okay? And after you've done this, because you don't have any money anymore, obviously you can't buy anything anymore. And if you can't buy anything anymore, eventually either you reach a new position of equilibrium with less output and less employment, or you start pushing yourself to start exporting. And if you're not very good at pushing exporting, what we do is we say you have to devalue your currency. You make your goods cheaper abroad. Okay? Now, that's if you're a deficit country. If you're a surplus country, what happens? Well, if you're a surplus country, fine. You simply continue to absorb the dollars. Say, I must be doing something right because everybody is buying my goods. Well, why is this happening? Well, obviously this is happening because you're not spending enough. But the IMF can't come along to you and say, look, the reason the rest of the world is in deficit is because you're not buying enough of their goods. And this is what we call asymmetric adjustment. Because they've got reserves, they've got all the dollars, they don't have to do anything. Okay, the surplus countries can just sit there and laugh and say, oh, look at these poor countries. Sorry, you know, they've got to take the IMF, they have to have conditionality, they have to have a recession. We're doing fine. Okay. Now, basically, if you have large international imbalances, it's because there is no adjustment mechanism. And one of the reasons that we had the crisis was the absence of any kind of adjustment mechanism in the international system. So we can say, well, basically, maybe it wasn't just the fact that, you know, people in Asia just really don't like to spend a lot, which is always hard to believe. I've never run into anybody who didn't like to spend. Basically, the problem may have been that it was the way the international system is set up, the lack of any appropriate adjustment mechanism, which, in fact, creates that difficulty. Domestic level. Okay. On the domestic level, if we look at what was happening over the period of the crisis, we find that the U.S. economy was growing at record rates. That is, we had periods in which the growth rate for periods of almost 10 years was running at 4%, more or less a post-war record. Productivity was growing at absolutely record rates. And corporate profits were growing at absolutely record rates. What was happening to wages? Wages were not going up at all. In fact, through most of the period, real wages were going down. So that real wages were not keeping step with productivity growth. So that there was an ever-increasing unequal distribution of income that was being created. Now, within that particular framework, we can also say that if we look across countries, that there was also an increasing inequality in incomes. So it wasn't only within countries, but also across countries. And even we can go to other non-US countries. We talk about developing countries later. We found that even in a large number of developing countries in this period, although they were also growing at historically high and sustained rates, that income distribution was becoming more unequal. Okay? So this is a second structural factor that was being produced by the expansion. And as we say, something that can't go on forever, won't go on forever, increasing inequalities in income tend eventually to be reversed. It's just a question of how they get reversed. Another structural cause, globalization. Okay, all of these profits that the firms were earning, where did they go? Well, a large proportion of them went abroad. They went abroad why? Well, we've already talked about the private equity firms that were pushing firms to increase their rates of return. Part of that increased profitability was the fact that they were reducing employment and investment in the United States and outsourcing. That is, they were outsourcing employment, they were moving investment aside. So that the U.S. imbalance tended to get worse, but it got worse, why? Because the imports that were coming into the United States were the imports that were being produced by U.S. companies who had outsourced their production facilities and their employment to the rest of the world. So that on the one hand, everybody is saying, oh, it's terrible, the U.S. is importing more than it exports, and on the other hand, U.S. firms were saying, well, this is really not such a big problem, because all of those imports represent the fact that I can now produce these goods at 50% or 60% less in terms of labor costs, and therefore 60% more in terms of profitability than if I produce them at home. So that really imports are not such a bad idea, because those imports are in fact much of the source of the profitability of the U.S. companies. And they were also a source of much of the inequality in income. Now, the other side of that story is what? It's because the imports were very cheap and developing countries tended to expand in terms of the production of lower quality imports, is that despite the fact that wages were not rising, the prices of consumer goods were not rising. So that the imports were also contributing to the stability of prices. And of course, that stability of prices, if you remember the low interest rates, also fed into the fact of low interest rates. So next structural factor is that if all of these profits are going abroad and real incomes are not increasing, how in the world was everybody growing so rapidly? Well, basically, that households who were increasing their spending while their incomes were not going up were doing so by borrowing. They were borrowing from the firms who were happy to lend to them, but they were primarily borrowing by increasing their indebtedness through the housing market. That is, it became very easy with the rising house prices and the falling interest rates to refinance your mortgage. Okay, so say you had a mortgage on your house that was worth $100,000 and you were paying 10%. 2 or 3 years later, interest rates have gone down to 5%. You're saying, why should I pay 10% to the bank? I'll go to the bank and ask them for a new deal. Bank says, okay, you can have a loan now at 5%. So suddenly, the amount that I have to pay every month is reduced by a half. At the same time, the value of the house has gone from 100 to 200,000. So you say to the banker, look, don't you think you can lend me some more on the house? I mean, it was worth $100,000 3 years ago. Now it's worth $200,000. Why don't you lend me $200,000? Banker says, okay, house is collateral. So now what have you got? You walk out of the banker's office with $100,000 in your pocket, and you're paying half as much as interest as you did before. Okay? You're rich. Your income isn't going up. You have no increased possibility to repay that loan, but suddenly you're rich. You've got $100,000 that you can use to spend, and you've got an increase in your disposable income. And this is much of how the expansion in demand was financed. That is, it was financed simply by borrowing. So housing finance then turned out to be one of the basic areas that went in to reinforce, because if you look at all of these, what we can call structural causes, they created a system in which what was necessary? Well, it was necessary for a whole bunch of things that couldn't go on forever, had to go on forever, if the system wasn't going to collapse. Okay? That is, the international imbalances had to keep growing. That is, profits had to be increasing. Productivity had to continue rising. Globalization had to continue increasing. Households had to continue borrowing. House prices had to continue rising, because this is what was at the basis of the entire expansion. As I say, we know that something that can't go on forever can't go on forever. Eventually, somebody will say, hey, how are you going to pay me back? Or we're back to Khursheed and his credit default swaps. Mexico went bankrupt. Give me the money. Oh, sorry. Don't got it. Okay. So what we have here is what we could call a structural explanation of the crisis. It wasn't any particular individual thing. All those individual things played a role, but the fact that we had set up a system that was structurally unsustainable that eventually brought the system to an end. And this is a kind of system, if you look at it, is very similar on a global level to what Hyman Binsky called the Ponzi scheme. Okay. You know what a Ponzi scheme is? I'm sure a lot of you have run Ponzi schemes, no? No, you haven't. But maybe you had a chain letter once in your life. You know, somebody said to you, look, here's a letter. If you send me $5 and you send it to another 25 people and you tell them all to send you $5, then you're going to spend $5 and you're going to get back 25. Isn't this great? Well, it's great as long as what happens, as long as everybody keeps sending the letters and as long as everybody keeps paying. But as soon as somebody says, if I pay the $5 and nobody else pays me back, then I lose $5, then what happens? Then it's over. Okay? What you're doing is that you're really not generating, okay, any real income in the system, are you? No? Nothing's happening. You're just, everybody's passing around the $5 bills and everybody thinks they're getting rich, but nothing's happening. And basically this is what we were looking at, or in a sense what we were looking at in terms of we had the crisis. Okay? So these are two alternative ways of looking at how we got into this crisis position. You can say, yeah, there are all sorts of little bits and pieces. Or you can say that what we had done was to set up more or less a global or a gigantic set of structural imbalances. And those structural imbalances really had to come to an end at one point. Now, if we look at, again, the role of finance, and we can go through this now relatively quickly because we've talked about some of this on the way. The particular role of the financial sector, yeah, I just checked my watch, so I hope I'm okay. We'll see how this works out. If we look at the role of finance, I've already mentioned the private equity funds. Private equity funds had two big impacts. One was the pressure on profits and also the pressure on wages. Okay? So that the outsourcing, you had outsourcing both of jobs and investment. This produced, on the one hand, price stability, lower import prices, and lower wage costs. Okay? If you remember, well, you probably don't remember. All of you look pretty young. It's too bad. Well, for me, it's too bad. But in the old days, we used to have this problem that we had inflation. And inflation was always because wages were going up too fast. Okay? People were greedy. They wanted to be paid more than they were worth. And we said that our biggest problem is trying to keep wages down because that will keep prices down. Well, what we did here was to create a very, very efficient mechanism for keeping wages down. Okay? Now, that mechanism through the private equity funds is really not a new mechanism. Okay? What's the best way to keep wages down? Get rid of jobs, get rid of the demand for labor. And basically that's what outsourcing was. It said, okay, sorry, we can buy labor much more cheaply outside than we can buy it inside. So, you know, you don't want to work for a lower wage, sorry, then you just don't work at all. Okay, so that was one of the big impacts that the financial sector had in creating, and remember that part of this is at the source of the global imbalances. Okay, the global imbalances were there precisely because of this imbalance in purchasing power. Secondly, mortgage financing. Mortgage financing provided the lending which allowed the consumers to increase their indebtedness. Okay, so without the financial sector, that particular structural imbalance would not have existed. We had things that were set up that were called real return investment funds. Okay, now this is something that we haven't talked about yet, but our particularly important in terms of the turning point in the crisis. Real return investment funds are what? Well, we're back to this idea of protection, protecting against the risk of the Mexican bond, protecting against the risk of the erosion in the real value of your accumulated wealth. Okay? If you're saving up for a pension, you want to make sure that by the time you retire, that pension is going to be worth something. Now, what is the biggest risk in terms of your pension, aside from the Mexican government going into default? Price inflation, okay? If I save $100 for my pension fund today, but the inflation rate goes up by 500 or 5,000%, by the time I retire, my $100, which today can buy a lot, he's not going to buy anything. So the idea was to create what were called real return investment funds. That is, these were investment funds that would protect the real value of your investments. How could you do this? Well, obviously, the best way to do this is to invest in those things whose prices would go up, so that you would then have a hedge against inflation. If you want to eat and you're worried about the price of food going up, what should you do? Well, you should invest in food, because if you own food, prices go up, then you benefit from the increase in price. So financial institutions sold what were basically commodity investment funds. That is, funds that invested in primary commodities, in precious metals, and in energy. Okay? Now, this was a very good idea, right? To be honest, that when I was very young, I had to set up an investment retirement account. It's called an IRA. I'm thinking, well, an investment retirement account, you know, if I'm very lucky, I'll live another probably 20, 30 years, maybe 40 years. Who in the world knows in 40 years what is going to give me a good return? So I put it into natural resource funds. Okay? Some years I did great, some years I did awful, because natural resources prices are very volatile. But here, what happened was that you got suddenly a great concentration of funds coming in to invest in primary commodities. Interestingly enough, at exactly the same, or not exactly, but more or less the same time, that banks were starting to write subprime mortgages. And the result was what? The result was a commodity price boom. Okay, I'm sure you've all heard of the famous commodity price boom. And you've certainly all heard the story that the reason for the commodity price boom is that these Indian peasants just were eating too much. And if it wasn't the Indian peasants, it was the Chinese peasants. It was really terrible, because India and China were growing so rapidly that their incomes were going up and these people wanted to eat. And as a result of wanting to eat, they were pushing up the prices of primary materials. Well, this was, of course, absolute nonsense. I mean, if anybody bothered to look at the figures, peasants just don't eat a lot. And, in fact, if you look at the consumption figures, if you look at China, the share of GDP that goes to consumption in China, guess which direction it's going? Down. It's not going up, it's going down. And, of course, if you were saying that the entire global imbalance problem was caused by a savings glut, how in the world could it be possible that all of Asia was saving too much and at the same time eating too much? Doesn't make sense. It doesn't compute, as we say. So basically, what was happening is that you were getting, as a result of the financial sector, a tremendous boom, now not only in house prices, but also a boom in commodity prices. Same thing was happening in energy, petroleum. Prices of petroleum, oil, price of oil. Today, it's 100. Tomorrow, it's 120. Then it goes to 130. Goldman Sachs says, we predict that the price of oil at the end of the year is going to be $200. Now, again, you think, has anything in the world doubled in price like that in such a short period of time? In particular, something that, you know, it does have some supply elasticity. Okay, if the price goes up, presumably you can get more of it. No, didn't happen. And if you looked, what was going on? Well, basically what was going on is that people were really not buying petroleum at all. They were buying futures contracts on petroleum. Okay? And you can buy futures contracts on petroleum that, remember the credit default swaps? When all you guys were buying credit default swaps on stuff you didn't own? Well, in the futures market, you can buy futures on a whole bunch of petroleum that doesn't exist. Okay? That's why it doesn't make any difference if you've got a supply response or not. Price can go up. And interestingly enough, as soon as the financial crisis broke out, and all of a sudden the banks didn't have any money to use to speculate in their commodity funds, what happened to the price of petroleum? Okay? Ever seen a big rock go down to the bottom of a pond? Just like that. Prices of every commodity, what happened? They all went down. Okay? Indian peasants went on strike. No? Hunger strike. They were not eating anymore. No, they were not eating anymore. It's just that there was no longer any speculation in the commodity markets. So that, and then the last item that we have to keep into account is that we then discovered biofuels. Okay? Biofuels are great. They're going to replace petroleum. Okay? Friendly for the environment. Well, the only problem is that biofuels, number one, are not friendly for the environment because they, in fact, use more energy than, in fact, they manage to create. They produce more gases than they eliminate. But they're also made out of, guess what? Stuff we eat. Okay? Now, is this a good idea? Well, it was a good idea for those people who were in the business of commodity price speculation because if you look at very simple figures, for example, the United States decided that they wanted to use corn. If you're a corn producer, you discover that something like 85% of the increased demand for corn over a two-year period turned out to go to not feeding Indian peasants at all. It went into creating biofuels. Okay? So you ended up with all of these particular countries doing what? Bringing about a very positive increase in the terms of trade for many developing countries that were producing all of these things. Very large increases in the income of Iowa farmers who were producing corn, because fortunately the U.S. government prevents any other source of biofuels so that they have sort of a monopoly on that particular area, that provided increasing incomes, increasing capital flows to developing countries, and rising international reserves. Okay? Now remember, where did we start out this story? That was the international imbalances, right? Well, now we've got these rising international reserves. What are those rising international reserves? Well, they're simply the other side of those imbalances. But this time, we got to them from a very different explanation. This time, you get to them simply by the way the financial system was operating in order to maximize rates of return on private investment and in order to maximize the earnings of the financial sector. Because all of these real return investment funds, commodities price speculation funds, and everything else were done supposedly for private individuals. But somebody had to operate them. Okay? So if I'm Goldman Sachs, I'm going to say to you, look, you're worried about your pension. Give me your money. I'll invest it in this commodity fund. Okay? Now, if I'm Goldman Sachs, I know now how much money everybody's going to give me to invest. And I also know that the way I do this is not by buying the actual commodity. We said this is all done through futures markets. Okay? Now, in a futures markets usually tend to be relatively short in duration. Okay? You can get a futures contract for 3 months. You can get one for a year. You go out beyond a year, it gets pretty difficult. So if I'm investing your money, it means that we've got to roll over those futures contracts because they come to maturity. And when they come to maturity, they have to be paid off. Okay? Now, as these things come to maturity, they have to be sold so that they can be repurchased. So if I'm Goldman Sachs and I know that all of your contracts out there that I'm managing for you have to be sold, I'm sort of, because I'm Goldman Sachs, I'm clever at this finance stuff. And I know that if a whole lot of people are selling, usually that makes the price go down. And I know that if you buy something cheap, it's better than buying it when it's expensive. So I like to buy things that are cheap. So what I'm going to do is to say, gosh, all of you guys are going to have to sell your contracts, so the price is going to have to go down. So I'm going to buy it from you. And then when we go back and reinvest it, what's going to happen to the price? Oh, the prices are going to go back up. So now I'm going to sell contracts to you for the next period at the higher price. So, you know, I'm going to make the difference. And I make that difference just because I'm running this for you. So now, number one, I'm charging you to manage your pension investments. And at the same time, I'm taking the turn every time you turn over the futures contract. Okay? If you look, hardly any of these commodity funds, in fact, made money for the investors. Well, if they didn't make money for the investors, who made the money? Ah, Mr. Goldman and Mr. Sachs. You buy cheap and you sell dear. Okay? So this is the other part of the story, or the alternative part of the story, we can say, is that the way the financial system operated on the real system in order to generate profits for the financial sector was one of the main causes for those structural imbalances that we saw before. Now, if we look at the U.S. outlook, what does the U.S. outlook look like? Well, now the question is, Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall. Can we put Humpty Dumpty back together again? Can the egg be put back together? And the answer to this is obviously no, because financial institutions who engaged in all of these activities, okay, are now either insolvent or owned or indebted to the government. They can't do it anymore. The financing is no longer there. Households no longer have the ability to borrow. Not only do they not have the ability to borrow, they have to repay debt. So the entire solution to the demand problem that we talked about before cannot be easily resolved. That is, demand will fall. It would be lower for a substantial period of time. We talked about, well, when the crisis was breaking, there was a question of decoupling. That is, maybe the U.S. would collapse, but everybody else would go on just fine. There were all kinds of emerging market economies that looked like they would be in great shape, right? China was going to grow at 10% forever. Okay? China ended up growing, well, at annual rates in some quarters as low as 5 or 6%. Okay? 50% reduction in the growth rate. So it was decoupling? No, it didn't work. Deglobalization. Okay? If you don't have the private equity funds, then the push to outsource and the push to investment abroad is reduced. So that part of the impact is that globalization will be, if not reversed, it will be slowed substantially. Okay? There is now a buzzword. It's called relocalization. Okay? What does relocalization mean? Well, it means all those people sitting in India, you know, talking on the phone are suddenly going to find there's nobody else on the other end of the phone, and all of the phones are going to come back to where they originally started out. And as we can see quite clearly, for example, in the service industry in India, there has been a very sharp reduction in the investments by U.S. companies in doing this. Basically, if we look at what the U.S. is undergoing, we have to make the distinction between what we call a balance sheet recession and a cyclical downturn. Okay? Cyclical downturn is what? Well, a cyclical downturn is that, you know, people are spending a little bit less. For what reason? Well, all sorts of reasons. You get a big snowstorm. What happens? Well, people spend less because they can't get to the stores. You know, incomes go up and down. Or it may be a slightly larger impact. Okay? You can have an impact, 1987, big stock market crash. Okay? People stopped spending for a while. Activity levels went down. Levels of capacity utilization went down. But eventually people started spending again. So it was just simply a level, you know, we're moving up and down. Because incomes were going up and down. Balance sheet recession is what? Well, the balance sheet recession is not only does your income move, and not only does your wealth position change, but you have to repay debt. Otherwise, you go bankrupt. Okay? So it means that this is not only a change in your income, it's a readjustment in the use of your income. Okay, it's not that, no, I'm not spending so much this week because I don't have so much. It's that even if I had enough to spend, I'm not going to do it. Why? Because I want to pay my debts. And I have to pay my debts because if I don't, then I'm never going to get to spend again. So that you're looking here at the difference between what we call an insolvency crisis and a liquidity crisis. Liquidity crisis, I just can't borrow enough. Well, yeah, people now can't borrow enough, but they can't borrow enough because they're insolvent. Okay? And in fact, the interesting thing about the current crisis is that normally what happens is that insolvency, that is being unable to borrow, illiquidity, being unable to borrow, leads you to insolvency. In the current crisis, basically it's been insolvency that has led to the liquidity crisis. Okay? Now, what do we mean by that? Well, basically, if we go back now to the example of our original credit default swap, okay? Rashid over here and I, we had our little contract. Rashid can't pay. So he can't pay. He can be illiquid. He looks around. Nobody will lend to him. Why? Because they know that he is insolvent. So that his insolvency then creates his difficulty to borrow. That is the lack of liquidity. Now, Gregor's over here. Did I pronounce that right?
Greg.
That's better. Okay, Greg over here is now looking at Hershit, and he's saying, guy is insolvent. I'm never going to lend to him. But your name is over, so I can't say what it is. Tell me who you are. Sylvia over here has got some money. She says, well, Greg over here wants to borrow from me because he's got a little business to do. He said, I know Hershit is not worth a nickel. And I know Greg's sitting next to him, and maybe he lent money to Hershit. And if he lent money to Hershit, then he's not worth a nickel. So I'm sure not going to lend to anybody. And there we go down the line with our name game. Okay? By the time you get to the end over here, okay, whether you memorized or didn't memorize everybody's name, the one thing that stuck in your brain was what? Guy over here is insolvent. And if he's insolvent, then anybody else in the chain could be insolvent. And I don't lend to people who are insolvent because I don't get my money back. Okay? And that's where this crisis became different from the other one. The insolvency generated the lack in liquidity. Now, what happens when you can't borrow? Well, if I'm a business firm, I can't borrow, and you work for me, I can't pay you. Because my ability to pay you depends on my ability to go to the bank. Okay? I'm a Chinese exporter. If I'm a Chinese state-owned enterprise, probably the state bank is going to fund me. But if I'm a private company, if I'm going to export, the way it works is that you're selling toys in Walmart, you have to fund my production. But if you can't borrow, then I can't produce the toys. So the Chinese toy producer can't pay its labor force, okay? If you're simply looking at any sort of trade, financing operation, in order for trade to take place, somebody has to put up the money, okay? Because I'm here and you're there, you're in Guangdong or wherever you are, in China with your toy company, and I'm sitting here in Newark waiting for the stuff to come in, but somebody has got to get us together to guarantee that you're going to give me the stuff and that I'm actually going to pay you. Who does that? Well, the bank does it, and it does it through a letter of credit. But the bank's not going to write a letter of credit to me to give the money to you if it thinks I'm insolvent. So we don't work. We don't trade. Okay? So this is the basic difference, and this is why this crisis has been so quick and so strong, that once it broke, that is, once people recognized, for example, when Lehman Brothers went down, everybody looked around and says, yeah, well, I know Lehman Brothers looks like you, but gosh, you've got long hair, but you sort of look like Lehman Brothers too. And suddenly everybody started seeing Lehman Brothers everywhere they looked. And they said, well, A world full of Lehman Brothers is not one in which I'm going to lend. And that's the one in which economic activity came absolutely to a halt. So the problem then became, how do we solve the crisis? Solve the crisis, obviously we've got a demand problem. So we solve the crisis with demand stimulus. But demand stimulus works for what? Demand stimulus works if you're in a cyclical recession. Demand stimulus works if you've got a liquidity problem. Okay? I'm the government. Or shit, I'm going to give you $250, right? So go out and spend. Or shit says, no way. I owe Greg money. I'm going to pay him back. So we spent $250, and what happened? Nothing. Okay? Hershit's not spending anymore. Greg's not spending anymore. But everybody's looking around saying, who's got $250 that I can get from them so that I can pay my debts? Okay? So the first difficulty is that if we look at the way the crisis broke out and look at the way we're trying to solve it, okay, it's a situation in which not only that people don't have an income, so they're not spending, okay, they have debts to repay, they have holes in the ground to fill up, so that the spending, if it is going to bring about any sort of response, has to do what? Well, it has to be enough to fill up the hole and then spill over to the outside. Now, the spending package that we've got, really not enough even to fit the estimates of how big the hole is. So everybody is sitting around saying, well, you know, gosh, nothing is happening. Well, the government has passed all of these bills and the deficit is going up and everything's, we're going to be in great trouble, and clearly nothing is happening. Well, the reason that nothing is happening is that, first of all, the size of the package was not big enough. Second of all, if you look the way the spending was done, okay, if you were designing a package now in which you wanted to get people back to work, you wanted to get Horseshit back to business here, to get people lending, you wanted to get households to do it, how would you go about the problem? Okay? It's very nice, okay, to have expenditures on environmental friendly projects and build roads and everything else. But the problem is that we don't have that we're missing roads. The problem is really not that we're polluting the environment. The problem is that Hershey over here has got a hole. And that hole is linked up to his house. That house is not worth as much as his mortgage. So how would you go about fixing that problem? Well, maybe we try to dig Hershey out of the hole first. But that's precisely the thing that we didn't do. Okay? Instead of having any sort of direct measures in order to get households back into a position of solvency or close to solvency, that problem got left to one side. Instead, we tried to solve the other balance sheet problem. Now, who were the other guys with the big balance sheet hole? Financial institutions. Okay? Now, if we look at financial institutions, number one, these guys are not really big employers. Okay? If you think of the employment coefficients of financial institutions, they are very low. Secondly, they really don't produce a lot. They're absolutely crucial to the functioning of the system, okay? But their impact on demand is relatively small. So that all of the packages which have gone into trying to fill the holes in the financial institutions have done what? Yeah, that's what they've done. They have gone back to filling the holes. But once the holes get filled, you have to ask the question, then what are the banks going to do? And everybody's sort of sitting around saying, gosh, you know, the banks are not lending to Hershit. I wonder why. And you say, well, I know why, because he looks like Lehman. And I know that I didn't want to lend to Lehman, and he still looks like Lehman, so I'm not going to give him any money. So even if you do get the banks fixed, that is, even if we do get the holes in the banks fixed, and this is what we're trying to do, it's not obvious that that's going to bring an automatic recovery. So what this says is that basically if we're thinking going forward, and a lot of people are now saying, well, we're going to get recovery somewhere around the fourth quarter of this year, or now, well, the fourth quarter, 09 people, if you notice, have started to shift into 2010 or end of 2010. So we're looking now, we're saying, well, things are going to start to pick up. Well, how are they going to start to pick up? And the argument is usually, well, the stimulus package is going to come in. If you look at the stimulus package, yes, the stimulus package has increased household incomes. It has increased household savings, which you would expect it to do, okay, on a simple national accounting basis. The government increases its deficit. This has got to show up someplace. Okay, where is it going to show up? Well, it's got to show up either on the balance sheets of the firms in terms of more profits, it's got to show up on the balance sheets of the households as more savings, or it's got to show up in the foreign sector someplace. Now, it has to pop up. The money can't disappear. Dennis Robertson is a very famous British economist that has a very famous saying. He said, any money that is anywhere must be somewhere. So if the government created it, it's got to be there somewhere. We have to find it. Well, we found it. It's there. It's in Hershey's pocket. The problem is that he's not doing anything with it. It's in the bank's pockets. If you looked at banks' profits lately, their profits have gone up. Okay? But they're not doing anything with it. So the idea is that if this is, a crisis which is not a cyclical crisis, then we shouldn't expect a very quick return, and that return will only come once the financial balance sheets of the system have been repaired, and at that point that income then starts to increase. Now, a lot of people have been complaining, saying, look, you Keynesian guys, you're wrong. We spent all this money and nothing happened. Obviously, the multiplier doesn't work. Well, obviously, the multiplier doesn't work because the multiplier works for a system in which people that have balance sheets that balance. It's not something that works in a system in which you have the private sector that is in deficit, in general in deficit. Now, this leads us to being 4 o'clock, and we should, okay, well, I'll just go very quickly through this, and then, okay, well, this whole series of contentious issues, which we can go through very quickly. First, the employment impact of the stimulus, okay? We had a big fuss about the fact that the government was spending money without direct impact on employment. Now, congressmen kept saying, oh, well, you want to give money to the states. That doesn't have an impact on employment. You want to give money to fix the environment. That doesn't create employment. No good. But if you're in a balance sheet recession, you know by definition that the first thing that money is going to do is not create employment. The first thing that money is going to do is to pay down debt. So you really don't care if the stuff produces employment or not. What you do care about is that it goes to those sectors in which the balance sheet difficulties are in fact linked to employment. So take, for example, transfers to the state governments. State governments in the United States have to run balanced budgets. Okay? Incomes go down, then their tax receipts go down. Their tax receipts go down, they have to either increase taxes. Probably not a very good idea when people don't have any money. So what do? They fire people or they lay off people. If you give direct grants to the states, then you may not create employment, but in fact you may prevent loss of employment. That is, you allow the states to balance your budget. So those are the kinds of things that you want. You really don't care whether or not it creates employment right away. Next, the deficit is too large. Okay, U.S. can't borrow anymore. Okay, we hear statements by the head of the central bank, we've reached the limit of money creation, we can't borrow anymore. Well, U.S. is going to have a ratings downgrade. Well, is this credible or not? No, obviously it's not credible. I mean, the United States government can always spend. It's always going to pay its pensioners. It's always going to pay its debt. Why? Because the president of the central bank has said, well, in order to create money, all I have to do is change some entries on the computer spreadsheet in Washington. I can do it just like that. Well, if he can do it just like that, then it means that the United States can never default. It also means that the United States can always create money. And creating money is, in fact, borrowing, if it wants to do it. Ah, now, there's the question. If it wants to do it, they could decide not to do it. Okay? Federal government puts a limit on borrowing, a limit on outstanding debt. You run up against the debt limit, you've got to stop, or else you go to jail. Now, do you think it's very likely that Ben Bernanke is going to be taken to the Washington, D.C. jail because he pushed the button one too many times? No. What usually happens is that all the congressmen get together and they vote an increase in the debt ceiling before the governor of the central bank presses the button to push you $1 over the ceiling. So that's obviously not a credible argument against the policy. It's going to cause higher interest rates. Well, it could do that, except that the Federal Reserve has already said that its policy is to intervene in order to keep interest rates low. Statement at the last meeting said, look, guys, figure on at least another year of more or less zero short-term rates. And the rest of the policy is that the Federal Reserve is intervening in the rest of the maturity structure in order to keep interest rates down. Okay? European Central Bank has just done an issue for 1 year at 1%. Okay? Doesn't look much like high deficits are causing them difficulty in managing interest rates. Then let's think about Japan. Japan has a debt-to-GDP ratio which is running around, does anybody remember, 120%, 130%? Okay, it's something like three times the level in the U.S. Anybody know what Japanese interest rates are? More or less exactly the same as they are here. So obviously there's really not a very strong correlation between interest rates and the size of the deficit. The deficit is going to cause inflation. Well, we're back to the Indian and the Chinese peasants again. How in the world is the deficit going to be causing inflation if nobody is spending it? Okay? On the one hand, we've just made an argument which says that the spending is useless because it's not increasing employment and it's not increasing spending. And now you're turning around at the same time and saying, yeah, but if you spend all this money by creating the deficit, it's going to cause inflation. Okay, what is this? These are these famous levitating prices. They're just going to go up without anybody buying more. Well, if they go up without anybody buying more, then nobody is going to be selling more, and the prices eventually are going to have to come down. So the other thing, exit strategies. How do we get out of these massive deficits? Well, memories are short. Anybody remember the 1990s? The U.S. had a not a large deficit, but a nice deficit. U.S. started to grow. We already mentioned it grew at about 4% over a period of about 10 years. And where did the deficit go? What was the exit strategy? All of a sudden, it just disappeared. And Alan Greenspan, who was head of the central bank, said, this is terrible. Now, that sounds sort of funny for a central bank president to say that the deficit disappearing is terrible because they always keep telling us the deficits are awful. But Greenspan said, no, the deficit is terrible because in order to keep the money supply under control, in order to increase the money supply, I've got to be able to buy something. And if there are no government debts to buy because the government is running a surplus, what am I going to do? I'm going to have to buy IBM. We're going to have to socialize the American economy just because we've got rid of the deficit. This is terrible. So very quickly, George Bush came in and got the deficit back, so we didn't have to socialize the economy. But at the same time, the idea was that because the government was running the deficit, the government was taking over the economy. And we have to try and be logically coherent in terms of these arguments. Inflation is not a logically coherent argument. Exit strategies are not a logical coherent argument. You don't need an exit strategy. If you recover, you get the limit. So beyond that, Fed policy and Treasury policy, this we've already talked about this. Fed policy basically is to keep interest rates as low as you possibly can. And the Treasury policy is to give as much money to the financial institutions as you possibly can. And every once in a while, you get a congressional committee which says that, oh, yeah, there are these people with houses. What are we going to do about them? And they keep proposing things to try and do something about them, which, in fact, never seem to work. So that the one part of the story that seems to get left out in the thing is always the poor people who actually do the spending, the people who actually have the debts, and the ones who are, in fact, losing their jobs. Would more or less been left out of the have been left out of the story. Now these are all things we don't have to go through. And do you want to see the pictures? Or you want to have the break? You want to see some pictures? Okay. Household debt to GDP. Okay. If you look, this is what we were talking about. The these are the ratios: household debt to GDP, and this is deviation from trend values. So if you look by the end of 2007, you take the big red line. This is household debt to assets, the black line, debt to GDP. You were 16% above what had been the average over the period of the last, I can't remember now exactly how we calculated these things. I think it's the last 15 years. Okay? So basically, this is what we're talking about. And all of that excess is basically what? That was consumption. That's what drove the growth rates. And that's what drove the international imbalances, and that's what drove Chinese exports. Okay? If we want to always make sure that we follow the circle all around. Home prices. Well, we said there are the home prices going up from 1990 to 2000, more or less continuous run, and then when we get to the period 2005-2006, all of a sudden they start to level off and they start to collapse. And basically, this is the period in which what starts to happen, in which that giant Ponzi game or giant Ponzi scheme starts to unravel. Because when the house prices go down, remember that I got from my banker $200,000 and I went home with $100,000 and a lower interest rate? Now suddenly my house is no longer worth $200,000 anymore. It's now worth $100,000 again. And I'm $100,000 in a hole. And that's basically, if you like, the problem, the balance sheet problem that we're facing. What was the impact? Well, here are just some examples of the impact of the decline in liquidity offered by the banking system. These are retail sales and sales in food services. And you can just see that these lines just absolutely fall off a cliff, 2007. Real personal consumption expenditures. Same thing, total collapse. The last panel there is 2000 through to 2008. Total light vehicle retail sales. Okay, remember General Motors was having a problem? Well, there is General Motors' problem. Okay, you're going from the range there of 16 million units down to less than 10 million units, okay? You're losing one half of your sales, okay? Industrial production, consumer goods and equipment, capacity utilization in manufacturing. If you see in the shaded area there at the end, it just collapses from around 80 to 65%. Okay, these are the percentage of firms planning increases in employment or increases in capital expenditure in the next 3 to 6 months. Okay, again, this collapse, okay, goes from an index of 30 down to an index of around 5. U.S. corporate profit margins. Remember we said we had this massive increase in profits. You look between, well, if you go back between 90 and 2005, 2006, you see they go up to record levels. The big dip that you see there after 2000, 2001, that's the dot-com bubble collapse and then the subsequent reprisal. Manufactures new orders of capital goods, same thing. Shipments of capital goods, both rapidly declining. Unemployment insurance claims. These are people registering as unemployed. Starting in the end of 2007, more than doubles. Employment in goods-producing industries and total non-farm payrolls. Non-farm payrolls are the green line. Employees, the blue line. Blue line goes down much more rapidly than the payroll figures. Consumer confidence and expectations, again, also totally collapses. These are producer prices for raw materials, crude raw materials. Again, you can see the very sharp run-up from the end of around 2004, and then the collapse, which starts at the beginning of 2008. Consumer price index, there is now no longer any inflation. It's now slightly, the last quarter I think it was slightly above. It's running around zero. That one we can skip. Export prices, we don't look. U.S. monthly trade balance, we said that the effect of the stimulus had to come out somewhere. You can see part of it coming out in the improvement in the trade balance, and primarily as the result of the collapse of the import of goods and services. Very sharp decline in goods and services. Why? Well, first of all, nobody's buying, but as we said, secondly, if you can't finance trade, you can't import. So this is not all the impact of income changes, this is also the financing changes.